brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and tears here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Yo, 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 what's happening, everybody? This is The Last Magnificent, Terrence Stubbs, and this is the Contrarian Corner radio show. How's everybody doing today? I hope everybody had a pretty good day. This is Hump Day. This is my second show here, episode 2. And first of all, we're just going to talk about a little things that are happening in the headlines today. First of all, we're just going to talk about tangerinas, oranges, or some people call him 45, some people call him frump, some people call him chump, but I wouldn't even call him a president, Donald Trump, he submitted the fifth. He pled the fifth for every question that they ask him today. And yesterday, they raided his house. I don't care what you want to call it. It was a raid. If it was black folks, it would have been raid. But for him, they just said, oh, we're just going to just, you know, look through your things. Oh, he wasn't even there. And a couple of things happened this week. Rest in peace, Robert Mosley from Magnum P.I. And he was a pretty good actor. I liked him. He played in a whole bunch of other things other than Magnum P.I., but he was a really, really, really good actor. I liked him. But today, our main thing we're going to talk about today is the theory of negrescence. And for people who don't know what negrescence is, I'm going to tell you, it's from the book called The Psychology of Blacks, an African-Centered Perspective. And it's by Thomas A. Parham, Joseph L. White, and Adiza Ajamu. And I think you guys are going to find this pretty interesting, you know, this theory of negrescence. A lot of people have never heard of it before, and the only reason why I heard of it is because I took this class. Like I said, like it's called Black Psychology at Henical City College. And this kind of like changed my whole life, really, because I base how I feel and what I think about stuff that goes on in this country from these five stages of negrescence. And negrescence is a Latin word. And it means, it describes the process of becoming black or developing a racial identity. And that is what negrescence is in a whole, in a nutshell. If you want to go back a little bit further, a psychologist from Martinique, Frantz Fanon, he termed the coin to become black, which kind of beget negrescence. And that is, which that meant as a process of developing a black identity under conditions of oppression. So we're going to jump ahead. We're going to start with Frantz Fanon. Then we're going to talk about Professor William E. Cross Jr. And he included the theory of negrescence in his book, Shades of Black, Diversity of in Black American Identity. That was published in 1991. And it talks about, you know, these models of negrescence. And what they are is the pre-encounter, the encounter, the immersion, then the emersion, and then eternalization. And to become black, you have to go through each one of these stages. And we're going to go over these stages of negrescence, and we're going to talk about it. And hopefully somebody will be listening, and maybe they want to call in. If you want to call in, you have to dial 515-605-9800. So if you're listening, 515-605-9800. What I'm going to do first of all is I'm going to talk about a couple of things that I need to talk to you about, pay some bills. And the first thing is the Caribbean Corner is made possible by members of YizerRadio.com at $14.99 per month and or YizerTV.com at $24.99 per month. Members, thank you so much for your support, because without you, there is no Yizer. And Yizer is the future. This is the future. You know, people talk, I bet a long time ago, when somebody said, you know what, one day you're going to have a computer in your pocket. And just think back, a long time ago, like in the 60s, the computers were the size of a garage, a small garage. That's how big computers were. And if somebody would have said that to somebody in the 60s or 70s, that, you know what, this whole garage is going to fit into your pocket. Or somebody had a whole collection of albums and CDs, and somebody would have said, you know what? You're going to have 50,000 songs in your pocket. People would have said, you are crazy. You must be out of your mind. But look, we have that. We have computers in our pockets, cameras in our pockets. Would you believe how many things that the cell phone has replaced in our daily lives? It's replaced almost house phones. It's replaced cameras. It's replaced computers, because people get on their cell phone before they get on their computers. It's almost like a small tablet. So, I mean, you know, so the cell phone has put a whole lot of businesses out of business, like Kodak. Nobody has a camera. Nobody has a camera anymore. I mean, and then you can make 4G, 8G video sometimes. And there's some sites on this, on the internet where you can see that they've made movies, like straight up movies out of, with just using an iPhone or an Android. I mean, quality movies. You look at those and say, dang, you know, how'd they do that? And it's right in your pocket. And also, I think the most important thing is that, you know, these cell phones, they are, and that's what makes me think that these police just have, I don't think they're stupid. I just think they don't give a damn. I mean, whenever they pull somebody over, if a police just pulls somebody over for a stupid traffic stop, running a light, a road stop at a stop sign, and then they just get buck wild, they just don't care. They don't care. I mean, because they're not that stupid. I don't think they're stupid. I just think that either they don't care or they're just super racist. Because how do you not just de-escalate when somebody has a camera in your face? It just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense that you're going to go ahead and just kill somebody, or you're going to roughhouse somebody, or you're going to just take somebody and have your way with them, and there's a camera running, several cameras running, just like George Floyd. There were several instances. Sometimes they even have their own body cameras on. And they have their body cameras on, and they're still stupid enough to do something ignorant. I digress. But we are definitely going to talk about negressence. And the first stage of negressence is the pre-encounter. And so what the pre-encounter is, the pre-encounter stage is characterized by an idealization of the dominant traditional white worldview and the integration of the black worldview. There are two forms of pre-encounter, active or passive. People with active pre-encounter stage deliberately idealize whiteness and white culture and form an anti-black attitudes and behaviors. In this active variant of the pre-encounter stage, the separation of personality identity from the group identity is evidenced. And on the other hand, people experiencing passive or assimilating pre-encounter tend to believe that personal effort will guarantee passage into white culture, the realization of the American dream. Such people are highly motivated to be accepted by the dominant group, and at the same time, also the negative stereotypes of blacks of the positive stereotypes of whites, since their views are influenced and reinforced by the dominant culture and institutions. So what's that saying in a nutshell is, on the high end of the spectrum, you're an Uncle Tom. On the low end of the spectrum, you're a Sambo. Simple as that. Because if you're on the high end of the spectrum and you idealize whiteness and white culture, you want to be white. You think whiteness and being white is the end all be all. You feel that, and there's a whole bunch of Uncle Toms. Like, I'll just mention one, Larry Elder. Larry Elder is probably one of the biggest Uncle Toms that I have seen in my whole life. And Herschel Walker. But I don't know, you know, Herschel Walker, he may blend in on the Sambo spectrum because, you know, he ain't too bright. Uncle Toms are usually pretty smart people who navigate their way through whiteness in business, in politics, in entertainment. And they do so freely. Well, until something happens. And, of course, when something happens, you know, they kind of like, well, what did I do, boss? What's wrong, boss? You know, kind of like what Paul Mooney said one time, you know, the slave will say like, well, boss, we sure is hot today, ain't we, boss? How we feel today, boss? You know, aligning yourself with the dominant culture and aligning yourself with racism and denigration. And I will say that I was somewhere in the middle before, you know, in the pre-encounter stage, because I wasn't a Sambo. I wasn't an Uncle Tom. But I was somewhere in the middle because I thought that, yeah, because we're all, I saw this today. Well, I take that back. I saw it on TV today. You know, when we're little, you know, when we first go to kindergarten, the first thing that we learn is the Pledge of Allegiance. And right after that, we sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And that is, a lot of us, our first indoctrination into white culture. You know, you know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. We have all said that. And the fact that I still know it by heart says something about it, because that is the first indoctrination of black people into white culture. That's the very first one, because when we learn that, we are pledging allegiance to a country that enslaved us, that put blankets of smallpox and gave it to the Indians, to the Native Americans, who lynched us, beat us, castrated us. But they want us to pledge allegiance. And even a long time ago, black kids would get whipped for not saying that. And that is like a gross example of the pre-encounter. But the pre-encounter is because, all right, when I was older, and I didn't know. I mean, I started taking Africana study classes when I was like in my early 30s. So up until then, I thought that, you know, America was the best country in the world. We're the best. We're the brightest. We're the richest. But now I know that we are not the best. Because if you ever get a chance, read this book by Randall Robinson called Quitting America, how he moved with his wife to, I think it's St. Negril or somewhere in the Caribbean. And he had all these situations where, you know, America's not the best. I mean, like, for instance, here in this country, well, number one, let me start off and say this. This country has the most incarcerated people on earth. And the process of incarceration does nothing for rehabilitation, because you have these big, gaudy buildings, and you have 10, 12, 15, 20 feet of barbed wire fence topped with razor wire. And you have guard towers waiting for somebody to try to make a run for it so they can just take them down. And he talked about how the prisons were in, you know what, I think it was St. Croix. I'm pretty sure it was St. Croix. And that's where he lives now. He resides in St. Croix. How the prison is right across the street from a school. There are no bars. There are no barbed wire. There's no guard towers. There's no imposing big brick buildings. And the prisoners, they garden and they actually do rehabilitation. So that lets you know right there that America is not the best. And another reason, no, another thing, when I was in this class, I vividly remember that when this happened, when I was younger, I remember when Reagan shot down those Libyan jets. This was a long time ago, probably in the late 80s. And I was just so happy. I said, oh, man, you know, we're bad. We're powerful. We shot down those Libyan jets. And we made them look bad. And Reagan is strong, and he's a hero. And like, when I start reading this stuff, I'm like, wait a minute. I was propping up a racist president who shot down planes from an African country. And when he was governor of California, he wasn't worried about gun control until the Black Panthers start carrying guns in the street. Then all of a sudden, he wants to start having gun control. And that's why California to this day have some of the most stringent gun laws in the country. And another thing, when we were growing up, and this is also part of the pre-encounter, you know, my hero was, I didn't have any black heroes, I'll tell you that much. One of my heroes was the Long Ranger. I just thought he was like this mass mysterious white cat, and he got this Native American guy who talks in broken English, Kemosabe. Me like me too, Kemosabe. Me want to go around the bend, Kemosabe. I'm like, well, you know, it didn't really dawn on me, really, that this white dude has a Native American sidekick. And during this time, if you really want to be, you know, for real about it, he would have been on some reservation somewhere, and he wouldn't have been riding around with some white cat on a horse. He wouldn't even have a horse. He wouldn't be allowed to have a horse. But the pre-encounter in me was like, wow, this is cool. And then here is what really, really let me know that I was fucked up. I used to think John Wayne was a hero. And I remember I used to love he had a phrase that he would use to say, I won't be wrong, I won't be disrespected, and I won't be, when he said, hold on, let me get it right. Oh, he said, I won't be wrong, I won't be disrespected, and I won't be laid a hand on. I just think that was one of the coolest phrases. And then I found out that John Wayne, he wanted to beat this Native American lady up because she was on the Oscars talking about, you know how the U.S. stole their land, and they had to pull him back. I think it was a man. They had to pull him back and keep him from running on the stage to beat this guy up. And so, you know, I live the pre-encounter. And I'm glad that I'm way in the internalization stage. Because I said there's a spectrum, and there's the Uncle Tom, and then there's a Sambo. And so I will say that, man, I fit somewhere like in the middle. Like, I wasn't a buck, definitely. I wasn't a Sambo. I wasn't Uncle Tom. But I was somewhere between Buck and Uncle Tom, I guess. And I hate to say it. I mean, that's where I was, because I wasn't the one that would want to try to be like Massa. I wasn't the one that, you know, was groveling at Massa's feet. I was kind of the one that, if somebody asked me one time what kind of slave would I have been, I would have probably been the type of slave that would have probably been the one that killed some livestock, killed all the livestock, put a barn on fire, maybe burned down a field of wheat or something like that, and then I'm looking in the morning like, dang, what happened? And I'm the one who did it. Oh, my goodness. That's what happened to the barn. Oh, I don't know. I would have been the one who put the damn burnt barn on fire. And I'm asking who did it. That's the kind of slave I would have been. I mean, because I'll say that hypothetically, because, I mean, nobody would have wanted to been a slave. And nobody wants to be a slave. I'll just put it like that. So, you know, that is kind of my pre-encounter stage. And my encounter stage is, the encounter stage is characterized by a conscious awareness that the white world is no longer viable, and that one must find a new identity. This awareness is usually aroused by an event or events in the environment that profoundly touches a black person's inner thinking, spurring them to reevaluate the relationship between blacks and whites. And the event makes it impossible for the person to deny the existence of such a contradictory relationship. The struggle that follows the confrontation is composed of a mixture of feelings and such as confusion, hopelessness, anxiety, depression, and anger. The person has to search their own self-identity in relation to racial identity and their ascribed racial status in society. Now, this happened when I started taking Africana study classes. My very first class was Intro to Africana Studies. Intro to Black Studies, Part 1. And we read books like Before the Mayflower, From Slavery to Freedom, The Annabella South. We read, like, it was about 4 books. And when I started reading those books, because we started reading them, we started with the arrival of Black, well, a little, when it says Before the Mayflower, that's the most popular one. But now they use Dr. Karanga's book, Intro to Africana Studies. But this book, I mean, like, it was like I just got punched in the face by Mike Tyson. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, this happened. We did all this before we came over here in America. We had kingdoms. We had people like Mens Musa, you know, Songhai, Mali, Ghana. Mens Musa was, I found, you know, I was reading, he was one of the, he still is considered the richest man that ever lived. He is the one who created the trade routes, and he was a Muslim. He created the trade routes, and what he did, he traveled these routes and gave away so much gold that the world economy collapsed. It's almost like inflation, or because you know when you pour money into an economy and everybody has all this money, things start going up, and that's kind of what inflation is. And he gave away so much gold, he caused a worldwide inflation. And I'm like, man, I was mad. I was mad because I didn't know this stuff. I went to school all these years, all these books around me that I've written. And let me be honest, I have about 1,000 books. 98% of them are books by and about African Americans. A lot of them are sociology, because you know, I have a lot of Michael Eric Dyson, got a lot of Cornel West, got a lot of books about Che Guevara, I got Soledad Brother. It's hard for me to go into a bookstore and find a book that I don't have. It's just so, sometimes when I'm looking at the news and they're talking to black scholars and, you know, when they have black scholars on the news and they're interviewing them and they have their book collection in back of them as a throwback, as a scene almost. Sometimes my wife gets a little upset, and she'll, because I'll be looking at the books, I got that one, I got that one, I got that one, I got that whole top row. And when I started encountering this encounter of negressives, I felt confusion. I felt anger. I felt a little anxiety. I felt kind of depressed. I'm like, how did I not know this? And I'm 30 years old. I took advantage of the situation, and I just engulfed myself in any and everything, any book that I could think of. The very, very first book that I bought on my own with my own money, I remember I got my financial aid check from San Diego City College. The very first book in my library that I bought, and I remember this like it was yesterday, this is so funny, is Franz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. If you haven't heard of this, you need to read that book, because he also has a book called Black Skin, White Mass. And that's kind of like where, you know, his theory, his early theory of negressions, that's where that kind of borrowed from that. Because also, who also borrowed from that, well, let me back up a little bit. Franz Fanon also borrowed from W.E.B. Du Bois, because he, in one of his writings, talked about the veil and double consciousness. And also, I think it was Claude McKay, wrote the poem Wear the Mask. All this stuff intertwines together with progressions, because nothing starts with just one person. So we can go back to Du Bois, and I'm sure Du Bois got it from somebody. I don't know. I haven't went back that far. Du Bois, and then Franz Fanon, and then after Franz Fanon, we have William E. Cross. Then we have Charles Thomas. And after Charles Thomas, we have Bailey Jackson, who created the four-stage model of negressions. So the people who wrote the book, The Psychology of Blacks, Parham, White, and Ajamu, they borrowed off of all of those, all five of those guys to come up with this book called The Psychology of Blacks. Here it is right here. And if you get it, well, the front doesn't look like this anymore. This, I had this book probably back in 1995 when I took the class. But it's basically the same. They've added a few chapters, you know. They've, because this is the third edition. I think they're on the fifth or sixth edition now. But you can get it on Amazon, I'm sure. Psychology of Black, The Psychology of Blacks, an African-centered perspective. But anyway, like I said, you know, when I hit this encounter situation, I was like, I mean, I was blown away. I was blown away because I'm like, good God, you know, the realization is real. I didn't know what to do. I was blown away because I just didn't know. I spent my whole life, almost my whole adult life at that time, thinking that white people were superior, thinking that we were slaves all the time. And so I took, like I said, I took the one class in Black Studies, part one, and that took us up to, that took us from Africa to, I would say, probably the 20s and 30s. Then I took part two, and that took us on up to, at that time, I think it was Bill Clinton, even though he's not a black guy. But it took us up to, you know how we thought, and I really thought the same thing, too. I really thought, and I'm almost ashamed to say this, I thought Bill Clinton was the first black president. That's how corrupted my mind was. I thought that I saw him on Arsenio Hall playing the saxophone with those shades on. I said, that is a black president. And I'm like, when I started becoming aware, I'm like, what the fuck was I thinking? I mean, come on. I'm really thinking that this dude is the first. And then I saw so many black people embracing him. Arsenio Hall, Jesse Jackson. And what really, really made me mad about Jesse Jackson, he accepted Bill Clinton. Accepted him. And when Barack Obama got the nomination, I wish I would have had this clip. But he was talking on the show, and he didn't know he had a hot mic on. And he said, I just want to just take it and twist it and rip his balls off. You remember that? Yeah. I'm like, he's hugging and kissing on Bill Clinton. And I think some of the reason why is because he was so entrenched with white culture and Bill Clinton. You know, I used to be on this radio show called Front Page in L.A. I would get up every morning. The show came on at 5 o'clock. I would get up every morning at 4:30. And I don't want to say I was on the show. I wasn't a part of the show. But I always had something to say. And it was hosted by Dominique DePrima, and she is the daughter of Mary Baraka. But I would get on the show. I would call in. And when I would say, they would ask me what your name is. And there was about maybe five or six of us. A couple of them were community activists. You know, people, some scholars. But I would always get, they would always put me on hold, and they would always let me get on and say what I wanted to say. And I regret saying this, Now, but I said, we were talking about Barack Obama, and this was before, when he first announced his candidacy in Illinois on that cold day, in that trench coat. For a quick second, and you know what, those community activists and those scholars never let me forget about what I said. I said, maybe he should sit back and wait. Let Hillary run. Let her win. Because we cannot deal with Bush. And I tell you, that's probably one of the biggest mistakes I have ever said in my life. Because I went on and he won. It didn't take me long to get on the Obama bandwagon. A lot of people are still not on it. A lot of people hate him. I'm talking about black people. A lot of black people don't like Obama. They never did. They never will. When I ask them who would be better, they always name some old candidate that'll never win a dog catcher's election. You know, some green party or some obscure party that won't have a chance to even, go ahead and do what you want to do, but you know what? A lot of people, I know a lot of black nationalists who voted for, I can't remember the guy's name, but he was part of the Green Party, had a black woman as a running mate. Can't remember his name, but they were like, I'm not voting for Obama. Fuck Obama. But I ended up working on his campaign. He had headquarters like right down the street because I lived in Inglewood. I lived in downtown Inglewood. And Inglewood, like I was about six blocks from Randy's Donuts and maybe about a mile from Fat Burger. Maybe about two or three blocks from Woody's Barbecue. And most importantly, I was maybe six blocks from KJLH, Stevie Wonder's radio station. But anyway, I'm like, let him sit back and, it's not his time. But like I said, I ended up working for his campaign, making calls. I bet I made 10,000 calls working for Obama. So, once I encountered all this stuff, I was mad. I was mad. Because I'm like, man, why did I know all this? When we were in school, I think maybe I knew about Harriet Tubman. I didn't know about Prince Whipple. Prince Whipple was one of the navigators in George Washington's boat. If you ever see a picture of him crossing Delaware, there's a brother on the boat, Prince Whipple. I didn't know anything about, there's so many black figures. David Allen. He wrote a book that was so inflammatory that they don't even know how he got killed. He just disappeared one day. It's a long name. But the brother wrote this book, and it was one of the, the books to go to. And he talked about, I wish I could remember the name of the book. It's a thin pamphlet. Started off as a pamphlet, and it grew into a small book. But I didn't know about him. I didn't know about Prince Hall, first black Mason. I didn't know about that jazz is America's only original art form. Everything else has been borrowed. In the history of where jazz came from, I didn't know about that. You know, it started out with, all right, I'm going to give you just a real, real quick history of African-American music, well, American music. First was the drums of Africa. That was the first. During the Middle Passage, it was the moans of the slave ships. The moans, the screams, the hollers. Because you had, during the slave trade, that, you know, so many Africans jumped over the side of the boat, ships.
Yeah.
But so many black people, and then, of course, you know, many, many died on the way here. Because, you know, they had them stacked like, you know, they spooned them, you know, and, you know, you might be laying on somebody who, or somebody might be laying on you who's dead, been dead for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, and vomit all over you and shit all over you. And so that's why they call it the, you know, the moans of the Middle Passage. Then when we got over here, they had the field hollers. You know, oh, you know, the songs, you know, they had the field hollers and the they would yell and holler in the fields, because I mean, you know, and white folks was like, what, these black folks are living under some of the most horrific circumstances, we ain't paying them, but they are singing in the field. And then, you know, sometimes they had like an overseer who was a black guy, and you know, he didn't want to hurt the slaves, but what he would do is they learned how to crack that whip where it was just miss them by inches. And they would holler. And that was kind of like the field holler. And it turned into almost like music. He cracked that whip, oh, you know, and you know, but he didn't touch them. But don't get me wrong, you did have some overseers, or I don't want to call them overseers, but, you know, yes men, or no, what they called them was straw boss, because they wasn't bossing nothing except for the straw. Once we were freed, quasi-freed, the field holler transferred into the works, the chain gang songs. You know, they're working on the chain gang, and they have chains on their ankles, and they got the big, I guess you would call them crowbars, and they're singing, you know, and they hit the steel railroad track, and that's part of it. That's part of our history. Then went from the chain gangs to UB Blake. Ragtime, sorry. UB Blake. It went from chain gangs to ragtime. A real fast, syncopated, you know, if you look at some of those old videos, those cats are tapping their foot real, their feet real fast, tapping them, and they're playing their asses off. Then came bebop. Then, of course, after bebop, jazz. Then after jazz, I call, when I used to teach art appreciation at Ivy Tech College and at Brown Mackey College, I would add the Motown sound. Then I would add hip-hop. Because hip-hop, well, it's escaping me right now. There were poets. The poets, they were poets. The last poets. They were kind of a precursor to hip hop. Look at some of the, listen to some of the music. They were kind of like rapping. They didn't have the catchy songs. They mostly rap or talk behind. They were speaking poetry, but they were talking behind, like drumming and stuff like that. Maybe a saxophone here or there. But that is the encounter stage. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the pre-encounter stage. So, you know, basically I'm going to sum it up. The pre-encounter stage was a stage where, you know, you spent your whole life thinking that white folks is the end all, be all. They're the greatest thing on earth. You know, you want to be like them. You are inundated with every kind of form of whiteness on TV, movies. You think Superman is the best thing since sliced bread. You think the Lone Ranger is a hero. And then you just, like I said, you punch in the face with like, damn, I didn't know this shit. So what we're going to do is we are going to have a quick commercial break, and then we are going to come back and I'm going to go over immersion. This is immersion. So we talked about pre-encounter. We talked about encounter when you realize what's going on. Now we're going to talk about immersion. So stay where you are and come right back and listen to The Contrarian Corner with The Last Magnificent. Yeah.
I gotta carry him. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the bag. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold like, yeah. Yeah, I'm so dull like, yeah. We gon' blow like,
Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping up. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping up. Look what I'm whipping up. I'm kicking up. I'm so pretty. I'm on Gucci. I'm so pretty.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm on Gucci. This is Belly. Ooh,
yeah.
On my Kodak. Black. Ooh, know that.
Yeah.
Ooh, get it, get it, get it. 100 bands. Contraband. I got the plug into a hopper.
Whoa,
they gonna find you like a flower.
America, I just checked my follow and listen. You motherfuckers owe me.
Get down! He's just a black man in this world. He's just a buck cord. He's just a black man in this world. He makes us a party. He's just a big dog, yeah. A chemist in the backyard. My very life is a dog.
Panera chefs have crafted a masterpiece. Chicken raised without antibiotics. Seasoned and marinated perfect.
No matter how pretty she is, you never liking my girl. That's how we run when you ain't around. I spank your son, keep him in line. If you should die, I keep him like mine. God forbid, keep this in mind.
magnificent. So I got another, I just got a couple of announcements to make. And the first one is YizerTV.com, the first Wi-Fi TV network. YizerTV.com is looking for product vendors that want to sell their products and or services on the YizerTV.com shopping channel. Must have a business license. To apply and get more details, email marketing@yizer.com, or you can call 847-232-9368 and then hit option 2. And the service is provided by focajob.com. That's focajob.com. focajob.com. And don't forget, Testimony, the Testimony 2 presents Lifesaver. It is a movie and it's going to be debuting Sunday, August 21st. One show is going to be at 4 p.m. One show is going to be at 7 p.m. You can purchase tickets online at eventbrite.com. That's lifesaver.com. I'm going to say that one more time. lifesavermovie.eventbrite.com. Or you can pay via Cash App at $TheTestimonyTube. And don't forget to add your full name, time that you want to come see the show, to the memo line. And you can pick your tickets at the will call. And it's going to be showing at the Indiana Historical Society. And that's going to be at 450 West Ohio Street, 46202. You can also call 317-502-2725 for ticket locations. And that's going to be $15 in advance, $20 at the door. And one more thing, ladies and gentlemen, is the Contrarian Corner is also made possible by ongoing individual direct contributions of $8.33 from the Talk To, from the Contrarian Corner radio show. Loyal supporters, if you would like to make a direct contribution to the Contrarian Corner, go to shopyizer.com. And I just want to thank all of you that are willing to give. And on behalf of myself and the Contrarian Corner staff and Yizer, we love you and we appreciate you. All right, now we're going to get into the immersion theory of negrescence. The immersion. Immersion. We talked about the pre-encounter. We talked about the encounter. Now we're talking about the immersion. That's I-M-M-E-R-S-I-O-N. Immersion. During the immersion stage, the person psychologically and physically withdraws into blackness and a black world. Black racial identity dominates individual self-identity, but the person may not know what it really means to be black, so the person may use the stereotypes of what they have learned from white culture to define black people and to act accordingly. For example, wearing black clothes, listening to, quote, black music, and attempting to, quote, speak black. The person may be angry at themselves for not realizing the difference earlier, and also angry at other blacks for not opening their eyes to see things clearly. In this stage, the worldview is either or, a dichotomous thinking about black and white. This mostly likely happens to black adolescents who can't find meaningful purposes of themselves for themselves and who they really are in the existing educational system. They may show strong hostility and anger toward others. That is the immersion part of negrescence. And I can definitely speak to all that, because I'm sure every one of us, if you're listening to this, have went through this if you are a conscious black person. I mean, I immersed myself in any and everything black. I mean, I devoured books, mostly history, psychology, sociology. I got turned on to, of course, I'm a black person. And of course, I didn't have to act black. I mean, because I was black in front of, you know, when I was with my friends, I mean, I grew up in a black neighborhood, act black. I didn't have to pimp. I didn't have to wear different types of clothes. I didn't get off into the stereotypes of being black because I was black, but my consciousness wasn't black. I knew nothing about what was going on. And I also was in the stage where I was mad at other black people who didn't see how I felt and didn't feel how I felt and didn't see what was going on. And who, I mean, I just got to the point where I'm like, you know, I hate to say this, but I didn't like white people for what they did to me. I didn't like them. And I did any and everything that I could to separate myself from them. I used to go, and when I was living in San Diego, there was a guy named the Conscious Rasta. I wish I could find out where he is or what is he doing or is he still around right now, because he was spitting truth, spitting big truth. And he just completely turned my head around. I got immersed in, when I say I got immersed, I mean, anytime somebody would do something to me, like a white person, I would be so upset. I never wanted to fight or anything, but I would be mad. You know, like, I would say stuff, well, you know, you want my parking space, you got everything else in the world, you know, but you want my parking space. And it was, you know, that was probably one of the hardest parts that I had to go through, because I always listened to black music. I always wore black clothes. But in my mind and in my psyche, I still was living and growing to the fact that I wasn't good enough. You know, I wasn't good enough. I was, you know, I remember one time I wanted to join the Army. And I'm like, the Army? Why would I want to go and fight for somebody's rights in another country when I got a piece of a right over here? That was my thinking. I felt that. I felt like, why would I want to do that? Why would I want to go and fight for? Because, you know, black soldiers, ever since the Revolutionary War, have fought in every war, and they were promised freedom in the Revolutionary War. They didn't get it, of course. Slavery went on for another almost 100 years. In the War of 1812, the French said they was going to free us. That didn't happen. World War I, when the black soldiers came back from Europe fighting for Europe's freedom, they were met with disdain, and some of them were lynched with their uniform still on. And that was one of the main reasons why the travesty of Black Wall Street happened, when they bombed Tulsa. It was because these black folks had their own area, they had their own city, they had their own jobs, they had their own everything. And white folks was just like, well, you know, these niggas think they just too good for us. They're looking down on us. So they went and destroyed the town. Same thing with Rosewood. Same thing with Rosewood. Did the same thing. Burnt and obliviated a whole town because there was one guy quoting, and this is a quote, I'm paraphrasing, he said, well, that one nigger, he got a damn piano. I ain't got no goddamn piano. That was just jealousy. So when I immersed myself, I ate, drank, slept. Every waking moment, I was trying to feed my mind, trying to feed it anything black. That's how I got my degree in Africana Studies. Because I didn't know this, but I had a forward-thinking counselor at San Diego City College. And he said, well, you know, you can take all these classes. You can take creative writing. You can take psychology. You can take sociology. You can take all these classes from a black perspective. And you can take them from a Native American perspective, Asian American perspective, Latino, Latinx perspective. You could take any class that you could take. Like I said, you could take creative writing. You could take English. You could take anything except for math. That's cut and dry. But any class that you wanted to take, and what it says on my transcripts, it just said I took English. I took creative writing. Because it doesn't mean that all these other people, they have bodies of work, and they, you know, white people are not the only ones that have a culture, that have a religion. We have a culture, we have a religion, and so does every other minority, Asian, Native American, Jewish, LGBT. You can take classes from an LGBT perspective, Jewish perspective. But I took all of mine from an African-American perspective, everything that I could take. And that immersion, and I mean, like I said earlier, I have over 1,000 books. And 95% of them are by and about African-Americans. And I'm telling you, I'm not going to say I read all of them, but I have read at all of them. When I say that, I may have read half of it. I may have read three quarters. I may have read a chapter, but I have had my hand and eye on every book that I have. And I have books by, and don't get me wrong, as I was learning this stuff, I also learned that there were a whole bunch of white people. I mean, let's just face it. We wouldn't have made it this far if it wasn't for some white allies. You know, I mean, people don't even know this, but Jean-Paul Sartre, he was an ally. He wrote Black Orpheus. And people didn't know this, but Albert Einstein was an ally. He worked with Paul Robeson to try to help black people. But one person that in particular that really caught my, that I didn't know about, because when you're learning about black stuff, it definitely has some white people in there, you know, who were about equality, who were about the movement. But I remember I was looking at this PBS show, and it was because, you know, I think Ken Burns, he did it. And it was a biography about Mark Twain. Now, who would have thought? He wrote Huckleberry Finn, which some people say is one of the most racist books ever to be written in the English language. But Mark Twain, he had a black butler. And the butler was very loyal to him. And so he caught the butler reading some law books. And so what he did, he paid for his butler, paid his way through law school. And the butler said, "Mr. Twain, you know, I don't know, I don't want you to waste your money. I'm never going to be able to practice law. It's just not going to happen." And Mark Twain said, "I didn't do this for you. I did it for your children and your grandchildren." And then the guy ended up becoming a lawyer, his butler. So, I mean, you know, I mean, you have to have some allies. You got to have allies to be able to make it. No matter what you do or how you do it, you need allies. But that's the immersion. So now we're going to talk about the immersion. Immersion is the immersion, the state of acceptance of the multitude of ways to be and enact black post immersion. Blackness. I'm sorry. Let me read this again. I'm sorry, you guys. The immersion state is an acceptance of the multitude of ways to be and enact black post immersion. The fervor of full immersion levels off at this stage. A person might begin to redevelop relationships with family members and friends who were cast off as underserving blackness. During the immersion stage, also during the stage, a person might be better able to control behavior and intense emotions when participating in the dominant society. So you know that saying, don't you? Okay, you were on this high. You were on this high of the encounter and the immersion. You wanted to just, you didn't like white people. You didn't like black people that like white people. And you didn't like black people that act like white people. You were just totally pro-black. Pro-black. You didn't even put cream in your coffee. You didn't have, I mean, you always looked at almost every white person with a suspicious eye. You were always waiting for that next shoe to drop. You were always waiting on somebody to say something crazy. You were always waiting on somebody to cut you off in line at the grocery store or dip into a parking space. You were ready to fight. You were ready to prove your point. You were ready to just show how black you were. And I remember coming home. And I remember coming home and in my immersion stage. And I remember my own mother. I was sitting there, and I found this little African store over on, I think it was Broadway, over by Crown Hill Cemetery, Boulevard. It was on Boulevard. And I was just amazed. And there was these two brothers. I went inside this African store right on the corner. It was a big old red building. My grandmother used to live a few blocks from there on Byram, right off of 42nd and Boulevard. I'm pretty sure that's Boulevard over there by Crown Hill. I'm pretty sure that is. And these black cats, I went in there to this African store. And let me set this up. There's an African store on 42nd that the corner was on 42nd and the other corner was on. They took up almost the whole, not block, but it took up the whole building. And on that other corner, there was a boutique. I mean, right next to the store was a boutique. Right next to the boutique was an Ethiopian tea shop and coffee shop. And right next to that was another little African, like where they did braids and stuff. And I remember going in there to get me some shea butter because I found this place because somebody, I said, well, where can I find some African, some shea butter? Because I'm coming here and I'm in my immersion stage. I'm at my immersion stage and I'm mad, I'm angry, and I wanted to support anything that was black that was going on. And so I went in and I found the little place, and I went in and I was getting some shea butter, and I'll get to my mother in a second. But I was in there and there was these brothers. And they were talking, and as they were talking, they were buying soda and some chips, sweeties, whatever they was getting, whatever they was. And one of them said, man, I can't believe these Africans came over here and took over this whole block. And I said, you know what, brother? And I didn't say it in a snarky way or nothing like that. I said, you know, brother, my grandmother used to live over on Byram. Two blocks away, about 15 years ago. And this building was empty then. It was empty 10 years ago. It was empty 5 years ago. And I left and I came back, and these Africans, I said, where were the brothers in this neighborhood? Why couldn't they get together and buy this little building? It had been dilapidated for 15 years, I know for sure. So what happened? Why? And then on top of that, you're patronizing them. You're buying stuff, but you're complaining about it. And they got mad. And they didn't get mad, but they were like, well, you know, they come over here and they get loans and this and that and that. And this. I said, no, not all the time. What they do is they come over and they'll save their money and then they'll buy something because they know. I mean, because you wouldn't believe it. Some Africans, they really, some of the older people, they really tell them that money grows on trees here. Some of them are brought up, just like some of us are brought up, like, you know, the streets in heaven are made of gold. People believe that money grows on trees over here in America. And we had a little conversation, and, you know, we split ways, and everything was okay. But what's so funny, what brought me to the store in the get-go is because I wanted to get some shea butter. And I took it over to my mother's house because that's where my headquarters was, my parents' house. And I this was way before I heard anybody talking about shea butter. And I had a friend of mine, she went to Nigeria, and I when I learned about shea butter, I wanted to know everything about it. That's how deep I was into my blackness. I wanted to know, somebody said, I got some shea butter. I wanted to know where it came from, how is it harvested, what you do with it. I mean, and I keep a little tin of shea butter on my person every day. And I don't even know how I still have this tin of shea butter. I've had this for probably 25 years. It's been lost, falling in between couch cushions, under people's car seats. And this thing of shea, an African gave it to me. And when she gave it to me, it was real nice. Nice little silver thing, and it had some shea butter in it. But anyway, I brought the shea butter to my mother's house, and there was had a big old clunk of it, because when I got the shea butter, the guy had a big old gourd, and it was probably as round as a beach ball. He cracked it open, and he just machete and just chopped and dug out a big old hunk of shea butter and put in a plastic bag for me. And he said, oh, that'll be about $5. I said, $5? I said, whoa, man. So, you know, I gave him 10 because I knew I was going to keep this shea butter for a while. I was going to have it. But I ended up going back getting shea butter. And my mother said, what is this? I said, oh, it's shea butter. You know, you use it, you know, it's like cocoa butter. You know, you use it on your skin and this and that. She said, oh, my goodness. You know, went out there in California and you just listen to them Africans and you just do whatever they do and whatever they say, you believe. Oh, my goodness. I was so mad at my mother. I didn't say anything. I was just like, okay, let me just keep my mouth shut. Because she, and then same thing when I came back, because when I was engulfed in my blackness, I grew my locks out. My locks came down to my elbows. They were long, and they weren't those manicured locks. These were locks. Locks. Not dreads, because dreads is a derogatory term to Jamaicans and people who have locks, who are conscious. I was going through my conscious black nationalist stage. But my mother was like, ugh, I won't just cut that stuff off your head. I'm like, oh, my goodness. Here we go. So anyway, that is part of my immersion. I was just like, okay, I'll let things go. Everybody's not going to believe the way I believe. Everybody's not going to think the way I think. Everybody's not going to, you know, accept their blackness. Everybody is not going to just be the way that I am at this stage in my life. So what I'm going to do, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to take another quick break. And we are going to come back and we're going to go through the last stage of aggressions. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be right back.
It's not that I don't want you here. Yeah. It's something about the way you stare into my eyes. I know that I don't make things clear. I fall for you every time I try to resist you. We can get away. Palm trees, beach views, ordinary day. All I wanna hear is in the pictures on replay. Sit right next to you. Yeah.
and I Contrarian Corner with Terrence the Last Magnificent Stubbs. And I have one more little bit of housekeeping to do before we let go, before we let you go. And we got about 26 more minutes until the show was over. But finally, the Contrarian Corner would like to thank you, our major funding sponsors, Digital Guard. If you need cameras for home or business, go to PreventHomeCrimes.com or PreventBusinessCrimes.com. These sponsors do the heavy lifting around here to make sure the lights stay on. Once again, thank you, number one, to Yizer supporters. Thank you, number two, to our direct supporters. And number three, our major funding sponsors. Now back to the Contrarian Corner and our last stage of Negreason's. All right, everybody. The last stage of Negreason's, Negreason's, I'm sorry. It's been a long day. The last one is internalization. At this stage, the dissonance between the old self and the new self, during this stage, the distance between the old self and the new emerging self are resolved. At this stage, a person might adapt a more nuanced definition of blackness and reject simplistic either-or definitions. A person's values and culture, cultural style, are rooted in informed African heritage and history. The person is connected spiritually and psychologically to an African descendant community. That's my stage right now. I think we should all try to strive to be in that stage. I'm at the stage where I don't let little things bother me. And when people ask me when I talk about Negreason's, and they say, well, how would you describe your internalization? And my internalization is this. Racist people are going to be who they are. They're going to do what they do. And they're going to say what they say. But me, I'm going to pick my battles. I'm just going to pick my battles. I'm not going to fight every fight. I'm not going to argue every point. I'm not going to nitpick at little things. Don't get me wrong. I will keep things in the back of my mind. I will say things if I need to say things firmly in diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's what's going on. There are a lot of companies are starting to have seminars, and a lot of companies are starting to teach this and have trainings. And, you know, there's more than one way, what they say a long time ago, to skin a cat. And I'm just at that point in my life that I'm just going to, you know, sit back and listen. But if I need to address something, if something is just so blatant that I have to intervene, then that's what I'll do. But it's not that I don't care. It's just that, you know, I'm spiritually and so and psychologically connected to my blackness, to my Africanness. I just am. You know, I feel a connection to Africa. I feel a connection to Egypt. I feel a connection to Ghana. I feel a connection to Liberia. I feel a connection to Ethiopia. I feel a connection to Uganda. I feel a connection to Zimbabwe. I feel a connection to Morocco. I feel a connection to South Africa. I feel a connection to Togo. I feel a connection to every African country. And I feel a connection to the Caribbean. I feel a connection to Cuba. I feel a connection to Brazil. Because people don't know this, but Brazil has, second to Africa, Brazil has the most Africans in their country. Second to Africa. Because if you look at a map, Western Africa is a straight shot to Eastern Brazil, straight across the ocean. Just a straight shot, and boom, you're there. And the slave ships, they hopscotched up the coast of South America and Central America, Northern America. And that's how slaves got here. Because let me see. I don't have those notes on me, but I will say that what is his name? I can't remember. I don't have the note. I am so sorry, ladies and gentlemen. But a scholar, he said, let me see if I can get this right. I'm paraphrasing now because I don't have it in my notes. I'm so sorry, ladies and gentlemen. That I think it's kind of like what he said. It's not the boat ride that separates us. It's the stop. The stop of the boat ride. So, you know, we all came here some way by boat, but some people stopped in Brazil. Some people stopped in Haiti. Some people stopped in the Caribbean. Some people stopped in Florida, Mississippi. It's just, it wasn't a boat ride. It was the stop where the boat let us off at. And when I lived in L.A., I had an African roommate who was from Uganda. And he gave me an even more extensive knowledge about my people. Very extensive. Because being around him, I learned about African music, African food. I make fufu and goat stew better than any. Well, I ain't going to say better. But I make some of the best fufu. That one time a friend of mine came over when I was living in California. He's from Nigeria. Him and his wife came over, and I said I was going to cook dinner. I made some fufu, goat, and a few other things, and they swore up and down that I had catered that in or I had somebody cook it for me. I could make injera. I could make some shiru, which is a staple in Ethiopian cuisine. I can make the kind of greens they make, chicken. It's just that I have totally engulfed myself in African music, culture, history, psychology, ethics. It's just who I am. Because from what I've known and what I've been taught from my family, my great grandmother, she was Choctaw Indian. My great great grandfather, he was fresh off the boat. He was African, straight up African. And I used to get up, when people used to call me, when you used to talk about me because I had dark skin and they were light skinned it, and they would just make fun of me. You know, they'd call me ape and stuff like that. And you know what? I didn't know this, but what would have been a real good comeback, but I didn't learn this until I was like, you know, older and have been through all my stages of negressence. A friend of mine said, well, you know what? If somebody talks about you, about your dark skin, we'll just say, well, I don't have a rapist in my family. And that right there just cuts it on off. I don't have a rapist. And that's basically what it is. I'm not saying all light-skinned people, because my grandmother, on my father's side, I've seen pictures of her, but I wouldn't say that unless it was of a defense of somebody talking about my color. Because a lot of times, it wasn't consensual, the relationships. Many times. More than you could probably talk about was forced. Forced rape. Because they didn't see black people, and especially women, as human. And another thing I will say is, what does that say about you? If you don't consider the woman that you're sleeping with a human, so that means you're inhuman. Because you're not going to see a dog mate with a chicken. You're not even going to see a dog mate with a cat. You're not going to see that. So that means that you must be some type of subhuman, or you're an animal as well. So let's look at it like that. So, you know, I wish I had a couple of callers, you know, that we could go back and forth on this about, because I'm sure that some people didn't know about negressions. And it's something that I always talked about, something that I always, you know, I tell people about it, but I never had a chance to have a forum where I could really, really talk about it and try to let people know what negressions is and ask them what stage they think they're in. You know, I'm at the last part. I'm at the very last part. And, you know, You have to go through, if you're going to be, because I don't consider, you know, there was a term that was out and about back in the early 2000s, late 1990s. People were saying they were Afrocentric. I have a book called Afrocentric Thought. And the people that I started hanging around with, they would say, we're Afrocentric, we're African-centered. That's a big difference. Afrocentric almost sounds kind of bougie. But if you're African-centered, you're centered in your Africanness. You're centered in your African thought. In your, you're centered. You're African-centered. You're centered around your blackness. And, you know, just be yourself. Be who you are. And, you know, just learn to be the best person you can be. You know, it's really hard, you know, every other day, you know, they show us that they feel that we're nothing. Every other, I mean, there's always what they call these Karens. And I'm sure you, a lot of people didn't know this. And I just learned about this just a couple of days ago. And it is so funny that these Karens are getting so out of hand that in San Francisco, they're trying to introduce a new law called the Karen Act. And it's spelled K-A-R-E-N Act. And that means caution against radically exploitive non-emergencies. Let me say that one more time. Caution against racially exploitive non-emergencies. Karen, C-A-R-E-N. I'm going to say it one more time. Caution against racially exploitive non-emergencies. They have to pass this law to prevent black people from being harassed and to keep white people from falsely calling the police on black people. Because I've seen videos where a black person will call the police on a white person and they're going to come up and ask the black person for their information. Why? I'll call you. Talk to them. I don't get it. You know, why? Why don't you call them? Talk to them. But see, like I said earlier, they don't care. They don't care. You'd have a camera in their face. They don't care. But we need to keep fighting. We need to keep digging our heels in. We need to be almost as we need to be just as diligent as they are. I mean, you can just see how they treat white people differently. They treat them with kid gloves, you know, because tell me, how do you, you know, it seems like you can always figure out a way to use restraint and de-escalation tactics when it comes to a white person, but with a black person, he gets shot 48 times in the back, running away. I mean, come on. So, you know, I'm going to do this last parting song, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to have a parting word. So stay with me and I'll be back in a second. Sorry, you guys. Here we go.
Crocodile by his nails. Hey, hood, candy bear hooks. I trail rides with hood, flashing backs on the top the way a gangster should. I snatch food from the mouth of a tiger, take a gasoline bath and I walk through fire. Bear hug a grizzly, suck milk from a titty, take the shards of that from its head and use it for a grippy. Spit in the crocodile face, have a benign named Swabba, two female apes. There's sleep in the barrel of bush and knives. I drink honey, straight from the beehive. Buzzy jumping off the Empire State, butt naked, rollerblading across the Golden Gate, butt naked. With the baddest man alive and I don't plan to die. When the grim people come, I look her right in his eye. I brush up in the face of the witch of the east. Tell a great white shark to go and brush his teeth. I'm the man who stole the golden fleece, and I date rape beauty right in front of the beast. The baddest man alive, and I don't plan to die. Come on, tell them about it.
I'm the baddest man alive. I take no medicine, I take no drive. Sometimes I feel like I can't fly.
Magnificent at the Contrarian Corner, and I just want to let everybody know I appreciate you tuning in and listening in, and don't forget to support our sponsors, and don't forget to listen to Talk to Tana, the Culture Kings, and Controversy, Moving Forward, and Peppy and Snap. I mean, we got a full roster of shit going on here. So let's go ahead and support and get this together. And me and Mr. Bernstein. You said Bernstein, right? That's my boss. So I'm just trying to get him in here. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, signing off, and I'll see you next week. End episode. Boom.